All right, it's 3 o'clock, so I'm going to get started. My name is Matthew Wilcox. I work for Intel Corporation. I don't change jobs that often, goodness. I was at HP for 6 years before I was at Intel. I'm a Linux kernel hacker. I was expecting some booze. Thank you. Get over it, because... I've been working on this little thing called NVM Express, which we're all hoping is going to revolutionize the storage industry. So what is NVM Express? It's a standard for PCI Express SSDs. And so I'm not talking about this kind of SSD, a serial ATA SSD, the kind you can just plug into your laptop. It's a drop-in replacement for a hard drive. Everything works great. There's very little work to be done. There was some work that had to be done to, you know, improve performance and reduce latencies, you know, really show off the benefits that this kind of drive can give you. But there was no real enabling work to be done. You plug it in, it works. It might not work as well as it could, but it definitely works. I'm talking about PCI Express SSDs. These would be PCI Express cards that you buy and you plug into a server. And generally into a server because they're very, very expensive. I've seen list prices of, you know, $8,000 to $10,000 for one of these things. Some of them are... Are you saying yours is way more expensive than that or way cheaper than that? The gentleman from Fusion.io is saying you glue 8 of them together and you come up with many, many thousands of dollars worth of cards. So you can see there's quite a lot of money to be made in this space, so everyone's quite interested in it. There's also a lot of performance to be had in this space. Once you're sitting on the PCI Express bus, as you can see from the diagram, you're much closer to the CPU than you are stuck on the end of a SAS connector. So there's a lot more bandwidth to your card and you've got lower latency. So you know, that's absolutely awesome. But the problem is that the programming interface is usually proprietary. And the particular problem for BSD people at this conference is that generally manufacturers aren't terribly motivated to release diversions of their driver. Apparently, some people are. But there are about 30 different companies making PCI Express SSDs today. And you'd like to have a choice of several. The other thing that motivates people like OEMs is that if they're all different, then they've all got different drivers. And this translates into a huge maintenance headache for a system integrator like HP, Dell, IBM. You know, if they want to have sourcing from three different companies, they've got to maintain three different drivers instead of just one. And they've got to QA three different drivers instead of just one. It's a problem. So there's this group called the NVMHCI work group. We produced the NVMHCI 1.0 spec in 2008, which was focused on client caching applications. It was heavily based on the AHCI spec. AHCI is the ATA host controller interface used for the controllers that talk to drives like this. And that was a very successful, the AHCI spec was very successful. Pretty much every ATA controller on the market follows that specification. We haven't seen a whole lot of NVMHCI 1.0 products. So the group decided that it was time to work on an enterprise version, something that would scale to the enterprise. And you can see we've got a lot of people on board, OEMs and operating system vendors and system integrators and producers of various PCI Express SSDs today. And in March 2011, we came out with the NVM Express specification. And the key ingredients to this is efficient support for small IOs, because there's a lot of applications out there that can really benefit from having low latency access to small amounts of data. Small in this case is less than 8K. We support billions of commands in flight, 2 to the 32. It scales very well for SMP and NUMA systems. One of the key things is that NAND management is performed by the device. I talked earlier about how there were lots of different interfaces. Many of the current generation of PCI Express SSDs have the host performing NAND management. If you're not familiar with NAND, it's a very complicated little beast. Reading a byte from over here can affect a byte over there. It means you need to read that byte and rewrite it somewhere else very soon. That's called read disturb. There's also write disturb. There's also any number of ways in which bytes can just suddenly start getting corrupted. It's very, very sensitive, and there's a lot of concern about just how sensitive NAND is. So this specification pushes all that work down to the device and doesn't have any host managed. And that's very different from a lot of today's PCI Express SSDs. My good friend from Fusion.io suggests there may be some downsides to this. I suspect we'll see in the future. And the most important thing to me is that the Linux driver I wrote was available on the day that we published the specification, because I'd been heavily involved in the work group, and I was able to keep up with the changes as we were making them. Plus, we froze the spec for a month before we published it, so I had time to catch up. So, an overview of the interface. It's a block-based interface. You tell the device, I want block number 3, and it gives you block number 3. There were other proposals that I heard. Some people want to do things like memory map the entire, all of the flash behind it. So you'd have, in the CPU address space, you'd be able to see all of the flash. And that was rejected. NAND just doesn't work very well like that. There were a lot of good reasons not to do that. Other people want to do things like have NAND management done by the host, and so the host would be aware of things like erase blocks and write disturb. And that was rejected as well, because this interface is supposed to last into the future. And tying it to the technology of NAND today was just felt not to be the right way to go. So you submit a command on a submission queue, and the controller eventually gives you back a response on the completion queue. The host tells the device, you know, I've put this command on a queue, come fetch it. We have a really, really small command set, and I'm going to demonstrate that. And we also separated out all the administrative commands from the I/O commands, so the adapter can, so when you're implementing the device, you can hard code, implementing these few I/O commands, and then the admin commands can be slow path, and you don't have to waste time, trying to figure out what kind of command it was. It's like one of these 6, and you're done. And these are the 6. Read and write, I think everyone understands those. Compare, so you can, it's like the SCSI verify command. You can say, is this data what's in that block? And the device will say yes or no. Flush, in case the device has an internal cache, you can flush and make sure that everything that it's told you that it's written is really written. Dataset management lets you do things like discard data that you've written but you no longer read. It's like the ATA trim command. You can also do some interesting things like, say, these blocks and these blocks are part of the same file, and so if I've read these blocks, these blocks are going to be coming up next, so you probably want to start prefetching them. And write uncorrectable is a command used by RAID controllers generally. You want to do testing of what's going to happen if we hit a bad block. Well, you can manufacture a bad block and test your code for correcting those works. So here is one of the commands, and this is This is used for both read and write. We've got an 8-bit opcode, and so far we've only used 6 of them, so 250 more commands to define. Each command has a command ID, and that's 16 bits. So when you submit your command, you give it a 16-bit ID, and it will tell you which one it is. Those who are paying attention will ask, well, how do I get up to 4 billion commands in flight if you've only got a 16-bit command ID? And the answer is that the command IDs are done by are assigned on a per queue basis. You can have up to 2 to the 16 I/O queues, and so that gets you up to your 4 billion if all the queues are full. The namespace ID, this is like a SCSI LUN. So you would have you can choose to divide your device up into different namespaces, and each one appears to be a separate device. Most people like to aggregate rather than separate, but you know, some people do like their partitions.
What's fuse?
Fuse is the opportunity to fuse two of the two of the commands together. The current version of the spec only defines the ability to fuse a compare and a write. And being able to fuse compare and write gives you the opportunity to put a mutex down on the device. So if you have two applications trying to synchronize and all they have in common is the storage, for some reason they can't signal each other using the file system or whatever, or signals, this gives them the opportunity to synchronize with each other. Basically, it's compare exchange on the medium, yeah. It's currently limited to some very few opportunities. We talked about some others, but they're not in the spec. Starting LBA tells you, you know, which blocks it is you want to transfer. You can transfer up to 2 to the 16 logical blocks at once. A logical block would be, you know, typically 512 bytes or 4K. So you can transfer up to 256 meg with a single command. This is way smaller than SCSI. SCSI gives you 32 bits to specify the number of logical blocks you want to transfer. But we decided deliberately not to do that because it would give one command the ability to tie up the bus for a good long time. And what we wanted to do was say, okay, if you want to transfer lots and lots of data, then send down lots and lots of commands. Don't try and have one command transfer the entire device. We have some data set management bits, which again are used for things like saying, this data belongs to that particular grouping, or this data is expected to be read frequently or written frequently. And so that allows a device that's composed of different kinds of storage. For example, it might be using a hybrid drive where there's some spinning storage and there's some flash. And it can choose, you know, where to send this data based on the hints we're giving it down in the DSM field. I'm sorry?
Which one of these hints is that?
That's DSM down here. Sorry, am I blocking that with my head?
I lost track of where you're up to.
Okay. block reference tags and the application tags, these are protection information. This gives you the opportunity to pass like checksums for each block. So if you're familiar with T10, there's something called diff. This is the same thing. The tags are defined identically. We have some file systems in Linux that are starting to make use of it, and we felt that defining our own kind of checksum, our own time, would just be ridiculously hard for people to support. So what we decided to do was just define it to be exactly the same as what T10 are doing, and then everyone should be happy. ATA, the T13 committee who handle ATA did the same thing. So I want to talk about the way that we do data transfer. Yes.
What does the DSM do?
DSM are little hints where you can tell the drive, this data is hot, this data is cold, expect to be written frequently, this data is only being read because I'm a virus scanning application, and you shouldn't update your hints for this data based on this particular command, that kind of thing. So NVM Express only supports virtually contiguous IOs. That is, the user says, write this byte to this byte of my virtual address space. So we support specifying which pages you're going to access. But we don't support having holes within those pages. If you look at certainly the Linux scatter gather list and the Windows scatter gather list, I'm assuming the BSD scatter list as well, they're very flexible. You can say things like, okay, I want to transfer 512 bytes from this page, in the middle, and then another 512 bytes from this page somewhere in the middle. NVM Express doesn't support that. It just says, start at this offset of the first page, transfer data from all these pages, and then stop halfway through that page. My colleague is noting that this is no different from EHCI and a number of other controllers where you have a very similar restriction. It is different from a number of from most SCSI devices, most SCSI host controllers. They will allow a more flexible scatter list. Certainly, Linux will send down IOs that are not virtually contiguous. I ran the XFS test suite against my driver, and it promptly crashed because it was sending down an I/O asking to read blocks 1 and 2 into this offset and that offset of the same page. And my driver at the time couldn't support that, so I had to go off and fix that bug and send down two IOs instead of one IO, which is really what I should have been handed by the XFS file system in the first place. So I want to just illustrate the Linux storage stack. So an IO will start at the top, at the application. It goes down to the VFS. Linux supports a bunch of file systems. Those which are based on blocks come down to the volume manager, optionally. I mean, they may go straight into the block layer. I believe the BSD equivalent is called Geom, G-E-O-M. In Linux, it's different. But anyway, for SCSI drivers, we go from the block layer to the elevator to the SCSI stack, and then down to one of the drivers that corresponds to the hardware that you have. And if you're using ATA, you actually go through libATA down to the AHCI driver. Because NVMe lets you support different priorities on different commands, we don't need an elevator to sort. This is true of most flash storage devices. The trick is not sending the IOs, sending the IOs at the right time, which is really the problem for spinning storage, choosing which one to send next. The problem is more getting enough I/O to the device. It's actually surprisingly hard to saturate the queues of some of these devices. To perform at peak priority, you need to get hundreds, if not thousands, of commands to these devices at the same time, or in quick succession to each other, so it's always got a batch of stuff to work on. I mean, it can be hard to get an application to submit enough I/O. The last thing we need is for the operating system to be holding on to I/O because, oh, there might be something else coming down that I could merge with it, or, oh, this guy submits an awful lot of I/O, let's let somebody else have another go. Get the data to the device, it can handle it, we can tell it what's high priority and what's low priority. So these are actual measurements taken on a Nehalem system. So this is the AHCI driver that I showed you earlier versus the NVMe driver. The AHCI driver takes 30,000 CPU cycles to submit an I/O, and return the completion. The NVMe driver takes 18,000. And we had done our absolute best to get the HCI driver down as far as possible. These measurements were taken back when we were trying to optimize for these things. So it's not that we're trying to make NVMe look good. We were trying to make AHCI do as best it possibly could. And there's a whole number of reasons why the I/O latency is so much better with NVMe. One is that AHCI requires you to read from the controller. The CPU has to send a request down the PCI Express bus to the AHCI controller and wait for it. And it can wait for 1,000 cycles just for the damn device to respond. And partly that's because that's how fast the bus runs, but the stalling in the CPU, it just boggles my mind how long it takes. No. What I did to test that was I wrote a program in user space. It mapped the PCI bar in, and it just did reads. Did a million reads, divided the time up, took 1,000 CPU cycles. With being able to execute 4 instructions per cycle, that's 4,000 instructions you could have executed. That's a lot of time to be waiting around for a device. So the NVMe spec, there are no reads at all. You write your command to memory. You write to the device to say, come pick up that command. The device writes to memory again to say, I'm done, and sends an interrupt, and the host goes and checks memory. There is no reading of the device. It's just all a matter of writes. So the AHCI driver was doing like 4 or 5 different reads of the device to pick up different bits of status information. So, you know, that's 4,000 of the difference right there. Going through the elevator code, that was a big one. Allocating extra memory. There's a whole chunk of work being done by the AHCI driver or by other layers on behalf of the AHCI driver that the NVMe driver just gets to avoid. So the driver I wrote, you remember earlier I talked about NVMe Express namespaces and how each one was basically a LUN. So we create a block device for each NVMe namespace. I'm not quite sure what the equivalent would be in BSD. Perhaps someone can enlighten me later. A geom endpoint. Okay. Linux has... 2 levels, essentially, of block drivers. There's BIO, and file systems will construct a BIO and send that down to the block layer. For most drivers, the ones that use the elevator that I described earlier, the block layer will allocate a request, and the struct request is what lets it batch up multiple BIOs in order to send down, you know, a larger I/O to the device. We don't do that. We just say, give me the BIO as quickly as you can, and, you know, we'll move on. Fortunately, the Linux geom, equivalent to geom, happens above this layer, so I didn't have to give up the ability to do RAID in order to get this kind of performance. The RAID drivers actually use the very same interface this one does. They just stack on top of this driver. So you'd have 2 instances of this driver, and then the RAID layer would stack on top of them. So the request comes down to RAID, and then the RAID driver, you know, splits it apart or chooses which path to send it down, and then sends it down to us directly. So we avoid the extra memory allocation. And this turns out, avoiding memory allocations turns out to be really important for scalability, as well as just latency, because, you know, you're avoiding a trip into the memory allocator. And we did our best to make the memory allocator fast, but, you know, it turns out to be a hard problem. One of the things we did for scalability purposes was we had in the spec is that we do have these thousands of queues, at least potentially. It's up to the device how many queues it supports. But if there are enough queues, we assign each queue to a particular CPU, or to a group of CPUs if there aren't quite enough queues. And so what we're trying to do is avoid cache line bouncing between the different CPUs in the system, which is even more important than avoiding locking, is avoiding actually contending on the same piece of data. Again, for scalability purposes, we target the MSIX interrupts. Possibly not familiar with MSIX interrupts. So when the card wants to interrupt the CPU to say, you know, hey, I've given you a new completion, it raises an interrupt. Well, it turns out there are three different mechanisms that PCI defines for raising an interrupt. The old one is what we call line-based or pin-based interrupts, where there are four interrupts and A, B, C, D, and it gets to waggle with one of them depending on it. That was supposed to go away with PCI Express, but it turned out everyone was still using it, so they couldn't get rid of it, and they had to introduce hacks into the PCI Express specification to emulate these pins that no longer exist. What was supposed to replace it was something called MSI, Message Signaled Interrupts. And what happens is the device sends a write of 32 or 64 bits to a specified memory location, and the CPU interprets that as I've received an interrupt. So it's a memory mapped interrupt register. MSIX was an extension to MSI. It's more flexible. It allows for the device to address different CPUs on the Intel architecture. So Linux has the ability to assign interrupts to different CPUs, and we make sure, and this driver makes sure that the interrupt for a particular queue goes back to the CPU that submitted the I/O in the first place. So again, we've got some good scalability stuff going on there. The command IDs are allocated on a per-queue basis. So again, we've got the separation of state between the different CPUs and the different queues. So again, there's no contention for cache lines. And one of the things that the SCSI subsystem in Linux does is each command comes with a timeout. So you set up a timer for each command. And then the kernel has to track all these thousands of timers that you've got outstanding and tick each of them every time you get a tick. It's handled a bit more efficiently than that, but it's still 1,000 things to keep track of if you've got 1,000 commands outstanding. So we don't do that in this driver because we are expecting to have such high queue depths. What we do instead is we record the time at which the command is supposed to complete. And then every second, we have this kernel thread that goes through and scans the array and sees if there are any that should have completed by now but haven't. And if they haven't completed, then we enter error handling and, you know, complete them as errors, just like a SCSI driver would. No, there is no relationship between a queue and a namespace. Any queue can access any namespace.
So it's a queue per CPU?
I do a queue per CPU. It's not actually laid out in the spec that you have to do it that way. It's just what I consider to be the best way to do it. If you wanted to design it such that you used a queue per namespace, you could absolutely set up the controller that way. There isn't a one-to-one mapping between MSI interrupts and queues. When you create a completion queue, you tell it which MSIX vector to use or MSI vector to use. So there can be many queues using a single interrupt. It's actually not all that inefficient to do that. Indeed, it may be more. I need to still do some scalability measurements. it may turn out to be more effective to have every CPU that shares the same physical socket share a single interrupt, and have one of the CPUs, the one that's receiving the interrupt, go and process the queues for all of the CPUs on that socket. It's a very delicate trade-off. We've done some work on SCSI systems. Some of the SCSI cards have multiple MSIX interrupts that you can do similar kind of tricks with. And it turns out to be very unintuitive how it all works. Yeah, I think it's something that people are going to have to figure out and tune for different systems. We've certainly seen the situation where having one CPU thread process all of the completions means that CPU thread just gets overwhelmed with interrupts. There's actually more work for it to do than it can handle. Equally, if you spread the completion data across all your CPUs, then you get lower performance than if you just let that one CPU be oversaturated. So it is quite tricky. And it's going to depend very much on the scale of the system that you're looking at. We've been looking at an 8-socket system with Nehalem CPUs in it, and that was where we found the overloading problem, because you've got 128 CPU threads submitting work, and that one adapter is interrupting one of those 128 CPUs to process all the completions. That completes all the way back up to the block layer. That's how the block and SCSI subsystem work. That isn't necessarily how the NVMe Express driver would have to work, but it's a big deal to change it for block. Yeah, I'm working closely with Jens to fix some of this stuff.
So just a general comment on MSIX.
Okay. The question was that, or the comment was that, the storage and networking groups at Intel are both fond of creating devices that support many thousands of interrupts each, and there's only a limited number of interrupt vectors available per CPU, and so we end up with an overloading problem. And the question was, are Intel going to address this? The problem actually isn't with the CPU. Each CPU supports a couple of hundred interrupt vectors each, and that's each CPU core. So on a 128 CPU system, you've got 20,000 interrupt sinks, right? So that isn't the problem. The problem is that some versions of Linux, and that certainly includes Red Hat Enterprise 6, probably includes some other SUSE as well, don't support that many.
So I'll disagree, it is a problem.
Okay.
So say I have 200 available vectors, and I'm using a previous T, which will assign different IDTs on the CPU. Say in the very near future, there's going to be a quad port 10 gig card for networking, and maybe say 64 queues, and I can have multiple interrupts on each one of those queues, and I'll have multiple of those cards in the system, and I may have something like this. You rapidly run out of
interrupt vectors. You can't use the device as you really like to. So then you have to start multiplexing queues on a single vector, and then you come up with a problem. Do you have to do PIRE to determine which queue, or do I have to just memory scan the interrupt? Okay, so
it seems like the IDT is going to be fixed forever. It seems like one little problem that Intel
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I can't talk about any future plans Intel might have for the CPU. That's not something I'm authorized to talk about. But I still don't think it's a real problem, because what you need is one interrupt per CPU per device, right? So if you've got 100 devices in your system, each CPU might need 100 interrupts. I see what you're saying about having multiple queues on a network card, but the act of doing a memory scan, I remember I told you it was 1,000 CPU cycles to go off and read a register on the device. Well, reading from RAM, if the device hasn't touched it recently, then it's a cache hit, right? So you're reading something that's cache hot, that's like 13 cycles. Maybe it's 15 these days. Anyway, it's as long as it's in your L3 cache, it's cheap. But if and the device has actually written to it, then yeah, it's longer than 13 cycles, because you've got to now go and get the cache line from RAM. But on the other hand, you've actually got work to do. So the case of scanning an inactive queue is cheap. The case of trying to figure out which queue has something on it is really expensive. And the case of, well, there's work to do, that's kind of expensive, but it was going to be that expensive anyway, because you've got to get the data that's in that queue. No, MSI gives you up to 32 vectors per function. The problem is that MSI can the MSI for a particular function can only be targeted to a single CPU because of the way that the spec works. You can always choose to use fewer MSIX vectors than the card has available for it. This is actually an interesting problem with the for driver writers, is knowing how many how many MSIX vectors to enable. This is something I'm hoping to address in Linux, and once I've done that, I'll gladly share my approach with you if somebody else wants to go off and implement it for FreeBSD. I think you had a question. Yeah, the queues do have significance for hardware. So the hardware will tell you how many queues it has, and then it's up to software how many queues it wants to use. And there may be a different number of submission and completion queues. You can have multiple submission queues completing to a single completion queue. And the reason that's useful is that each submission queue might have a different priority associated with it. So you can have a high, medium, and low priority queue that you associate with a single completion queue. And now when you get a high, medium, or low priority I/O, you choose which queue to put it in. And then, you know, hopefully the device will honor that high, low, medium priority and complete the high and complete the high priority ones more expeditiously.
Are the hardware resources partitioned equally among the queues? Or is the hardware allowed to allocate as many resources as required for the processing of one queue?
I think that would be up to the hardware manufacturer how they partition resources between the different queues. Certainly the spec doesn't make much distinction between the different queues. You know, it's not that the first 256 queues are special or something. You know, all the I/O queues are created equal in the eyes of the spec. And from a practical point of view, what my hardware colleagues tell me is that you basically construct a queue engine and then you copy and paste it across the die. Right, so I don't think people are going to actually create queues that are less competent than other queues.
The reason for asking was, if I need to scale my IOPS and I do have ordering requirements, ideally I would like to put everything in one queue. But if I can't get the IOPS in a single queue, and I would have to split it across multiple queues, but then need to worry about ordering the software.
actually you need to worry about ordering in software anyway. There is no concept of ordering in the specification right now. The adapter may choose to complete the IOs in whatever order it chooses to. So if basically it's using the flush foo model of consistency. So assuming you're writing to a file system log, what you do is write, send down a dozen writes, and then you send down a flush to make sure that it's out of the volatile write cache. And then you send down your commit record with the force unit access bit set. And because the flush is completed, you know that everything else before it was on disk. When the one with FUA completes, you know that your commit record is complete and on stable storage. So as long as you have enough other I.O. that you can saturate the drive, so as long as you're not logging every single write, you're going to be okay. You can optimize this flow. If the device doesn't have a volatile write cache and there's a mechanism to ask the device whether or not it has a volatile write cache, you can also skip the flush. So all you have to do is wait for your dozen writes to the log to return, and then you can send down the commit record with FUA, and you're done. Question?
Yeah, is this flush command per queue, or is it per namespace? How does it work?
The flush command includes a namespace field. The device is not required to honor that, in that it may choose to flush it may choose to flush more. And that's going to depend on how the device vendor has chosen to implement flush. Any more questions? Okay. So I've got some future work that I haven't done in the Linux driver yet, and if you go out today and download the Linux driver and look at it, you won't see any of this stuff in it because I haven't done it yet. The timeout thread is currently there's one of them, so that's going to cause all the cache line bouncing that I was trying so desperately to avoid with all my other work. So all I need to do is just make it per CPU socket. There's a really cool interrupt mitigation mechanism in the spec, and I think it's really cool because I designed it. It lets you tell the device, if I haven't acted a command in the last n hundred microseconds, and there are at least n completions on the queue, then send me an interrupt. And so by processing the completion queue quickly enough, you can actually avoid the device ever sending you an interrupt. And I've got some cool ideas about how I might be able to make use of it. The advantage is of defining it this way, rather than just saying, well, you can disable interrupts, is that this lets the device warn you if you're trying to go into this kind of state. It lets the device actually interrupt you and say, no, you're not doing as well as you thought you were. Come back, process the queue. I need you to process the queue. The queue's filling up. So I'm really looking forward to playing with that. I just need to implement interrupt mitigation in my emulator first, and then I can go off and actually play with interrupt mitigation and see how well it works. A lot of these aren't very interesting. SCSI ioctls, basically I want to be as compatible as possible with something that's assuming that it's got a SCSI device that it's talking to. In Linux, even ATA devices support SCSI ioctls, and we've got an emulation layer for SCSI ioctls. So I want to plug into that and translate, send random SCSI command into an NVM Express command, because I think that'll be cool. There's an incompressible bit. Remember I showed you that DSM field earlier that goes in the command. One of the bits in there says the data I'm writing cannot be compressed. And there are some SSD vendors out there, SandForce, I think, if I remember reading my Anantech article right, they actually compress the data you send down to them in order to improve their NAND durability and, indeed, improve their performance. So if you set this bit that says, I know this data is not compressible, then it lets them skip doing that step and just write it as you sent it. And the obvious two places where this would be useful is if the upper layers in Linux, let's say the encryption file system or the compressing file system, if either of those would set the bit in the BIO that they send down to me, I could then translate that into an NVMe command bit. Linux doesn't have an incompressible bit yet. This is something I need to negotiate with a few people, but I'm sure we'll do it. Data integrity is fun. The stuff I was talking about earlier with diff and dix, just being able to provide checksums for the data you're passing down. And the other big thing I need to do is I set all these data structures up per CPU, but with CPU hot plug, I don't then add new queues or remove queues that are no longer going to have CPUs to service them. So I just need to go in and make that happen and hopefully get my boss to buy me a system that actually you can hot plug the CPUs on, because that'd be fun. I suspect I'm going to be forced to emulate that as well, because those systems are expensive. So, any questions? I've got one. Well, I don't see any hands. No hands? Oh, a hand. Yeah. Yeah. Would you like to write one?
It's a great question. Where we can see it in metal?
I'm sorry?
When we can see it in metal?
When can we see the metal? When are we going to have hardware? I don't have any hardware. I wrote my own. I'm not at liberty to talk about other people's schedules in terms of, you know, when are people going to ship hardware. I'm certainly not at liberty to talk about Intel's schedules. I will note that Intel's roadmap for SSDs has been leaked to the press and seems to get leaked to the press on a fairly regular basis. And so you may find out about when Intel are going to do it, even though I can't tell you. A lot of the people in the workgroup are releasing PCI Express SSDs this year that aren't NVMe Express based. It takes a certain amount of time after the standard is final for people to actually produce silicon. So you might see something this year. I think it's more likely you'll start to see products in 2012. In terms of writing a driver, what you really want is an emulator, right? Because you don't want to have to start dealing with hardware. Hardware is complex to debug. Even if I could give you, you know, pre-production hardware, you wouldn't want it because you don't know whose bug it is. Exactly. So we actually have two teams at Intel working on emulators. One is based on QEMU, and one is based on VirtualBox. And it's my hope that we'll be able to release those emulators soon, but there's legal work to go through, and, you know, product development. These emulators aren't complete. I wrote my own. It's based on some fairly specialized hardware that, you know, costs like $30,000 to procure. So, you know, you can't have that. But a QEMU-based driver should be fairly accessible. I understand it runs BSD quite well. So,
VirtualBox
is better. You giving you a choice, you'd rather have a virtual box than a QEMU?
Virtual box is faster, I guess.
Faster? Okay. All right, I'll take that feedback back.
Just to assist in that, are you willing to release header files and have registered definitions and things like that under a BSD license?
Okay, so those header files are already available under the GPL. I mean, I don't...
What's the NetApp in that list of companies? What's that?
Yes, NetApp. Yes, they are. I don't think the interface definition is subject to copyright, frankly. If you take that file and use it under the BSD license, I'm not going to come after you. You can use it. That's fine.
As long as it doesn't say GPL on the top few lines.
It probably does right now. I can work to get that removed.
Yeah, I think it just needs yours or Intel
Intel actually owns the copyright, so what I should probably do is just go to the open source board and get them to ratify changing the license on it. There's nothing confidential.
Box, for example, yeah. Not that one, you see right there. The Linux helmet box with the V2L interface, and he said that as far as he's concerned, for example, the interfaces are not copyrighted. Draw the code and copyright them in the .h file that he does will always be just a .h file.
Yeah, exactly. As long as there's no code in it, and frankly, if there were code in it, I don't think you'd be interested in it. I mean, you want to... you want to do it yourselves, right? Yeah.
Can you go back to the slide where you compare NCN and NVR? This is on real hardware, right?
This is on real hardware, yeah.
This is on real RAM-based hardware.
No, this does not include the time taken to go from the controller to the media and back.
Not on hardware.
No. Okay. Okay. Not on hardware. So it's on a real system. So it's a real CPU. It's real RAM. But we've eliminated all the variables that incorporate. Like we've eliminated all the NAND. This is measuring from when we submit the I/O to when we touch the hardware to say, read this command, and it's measuring from when we get the interrupt to when we get back up to user space.
So are you at liberty to say how many IOPS you can expect in real hardware?
So the number of IOPS you're going to expect is going to depend entirely on, turns out with current NAND, the amount of power you're willing to pay. Not so much on your sector size. Okay. So turns out the real performance limiter right now for current generation NAND is power. How much power can you get to the device? In terms of the interface scalability, which is all that I can influence, with a DRAM-based prototype, we've measured 4 million IOPS, which tells you absolutely nothing about what you're really going to see from hardware, except that we know it can get to 4 million. Can it get to 4 million when you've got real NAND back there? I have no clue. Probably not. But the interface scales, and that's all I can control. The intent is to be able to saturate a PCI Express interface. No.
How many
lanes? Right. So, I mean, if you take the best case scenario, you've got a 16 lane slot, which would be equivalent to a graphics card, and let's say it's Gen 3, so that's running at 1 gigabyte per second per lane per direction. You're talking about trying to saturate 32 gigabytes a second of bandwidth. If you're trying to do it with 512 byte IOs, right, you're trying to do 64 million IOPS, and we haven't demonstrated that yet. Now, one of the things I actually forgot to talk about on my to-do list was write amortization. At this point, every time you put a command on the queue, the driver rings the doorbell. There's no need to do that. You can wait until you've got a dozen commands on the queue and then ring the doorbell.
You just said we shouldn't do it.
I'm saying the elevator shouldn't do that. The driver's entitled to it because the driver knows how many commands it's got outstanding. If you've already, you wouldn't want to do it in your ramp-up phase, right? If you've only got half a dozen commands outstanding with the device, keep sending them. But if you've already got, 500 commands outstanding with the device, and you delay this one, that's not so bad. So, do wait for a few to accumulate in the queue and then write the doorbell, and the device can come on and pick up, say, 8 commands at a time and go off and process them. That's going to... I mean, doing that would instantly turn us up from 4 million IOPS to 32 million IOPS. Right? So I think the interface is going to scale just as far as the NAND will let it.
Let me ask a question in a different way. Is the intent of this technology to be a replacement for block devices, or as a RAM replacement?
There's no replacing RAM today. Right? RAM has a latency in the order of 30 nanoseconds. NAND, if you can get it down to 50 microseconds, you're doing well. So there's a factor of 1,000 there. There is no way to treat NAND as RAM. I mean, we can be so much better than spinning Rust. Yeah, we fill this nice gap between where Rust is and where RAM is, but NAND can't do it. And NVMe doesn't specifically talk about NAND. It's no secret that every single NAND manufacturer is investigating technologies other than NAND. People don't think that NAND is going to scale into the future. Something's got to replace it, people say. People have been saying that Moore's Law won't hold for about the same length of time now. But people are investigating it. So, you know, maybe some of these other technologies, spintronics, memristors, phase change, there's a dozen different technologies being investigated. There's a Wikipedia page about them. It's great. You should read it. It's full of lies. You know, something could come along that maybe could replace RAM one day. This probably wouldn't be the right way to access that. Right, because it is block based. If it can replace RAM, then you should probably address it like RAM in cache lines rather than in 512 byte blocks.
This is a question which is not directly relative to just this thing, but do you have any ideas about how people are planning on addressing the problem of metadata size requirements?
Metadata size requirements inside the device.
But if you're moving your data around, you have to know where it is, otherwise you can't find it.
Yeah.
Which means that unless you've got, you know, like many gigs of RAM on your device, you've got to read the flash in order to find the data on the flash. Which means that everything's two flash reads away without caching, which you do have. But do you have any ideas of what's been planned in that regard?
I am familiar with the problem that my friend from Fusion.io describes, and I am not at liberty to discuss what actions we might be taking inside our firmware to address these problems. Do you seriously think I was going to tell you that? Yes. The question is there a way to know how many spare blocks are remaining in the flash? I mean, you don't get that from this today either. What we do provide is there's a wear indicator that's defined by the manufacturer, but basically it gives you a percentage wear. You'll get a number back between 0 and 100 to indicate to you how much longer we think your device is likely to last. That's part of the spec. That's one of the administrative commands. You can ask the device, how much longer do you think you have left? I mean, we really didn't... Manufacturers are really sensitive about all kinds of things relating to wear and warranty and all that kind of stuff. So it was fairly tricky to figure out, you know, to negotiate how are we going to expose this? Like, what are people comfortable exposing? And we just came up with a percentage indicator. It was the simplest thing to do. And it's the most meaningful to you as a consumer. How much longer do I think it has left? Well, at current wear rates, we've got 6 months, because that's where we're on the percentage scale. So, yes? So it's 4 o'clock. There is another talk in another room. If people want to hang out and chat with me instead of going to the lightning talks, I'm up for that. But I'm going to turn off the microphone. And thank you all for coming.
Who wins the SSD?
It's my SSD. You can't have it.